episode 209 of the Cricket Her Weekly. You join us at a rather sleep-deprived Cricket Her Towers because we were up trying to stay awake, Sid, just for the next 20 minutes or so. That also applies to you if you're tuning in. Just try and stay awake for the next 20 minutes or so and then we'll stop talking. Anyway, we were up last night, which is obviously the middle of the night, English time, watching the third England v New Zealand T20. And there was high drama.
Oh, yeah, a glorious victory from... I did fall asleep about, you know, 2 hours before the end, but a glorious victory from England, I'm sure occurred. And
I'm sorry. Oh. I'm sorry to disappoint you, Sid. So I think the equation was that England needed 33 off 36 balls with 8 wickets in hand, which should have been a walk in the park and was not a walk in the park.
No, exactly. That was about as low as the run rate, the required rate got. It got to down to 5.8 at one point. It was mostly hanging around about a run a ball.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just looked so well set. I mean, you know, let's think about the first half of England's innings to start with. And, you know, Maya Bichet just looked great. It was just like, you know, this was an even better innings than the 95, was it, that she got against Sri Lanka? Just because, you know, it felt this was a more of a pressure situation.
Yeah.
And it was just fantastic. She was playing all around the ground and she wasn't trying to, you know, go always for those glory shots. You know, she was happy to, you know, cut the ball through backward point and take the boundaries that way. So, you know, it was just really positive. And interestingly, the first game of this series, she looked quite subdued. She looked like a player that was trying really, really hard not to get out. And she looked like it was in her head going, don't get out. This time she was able to play a much more flowing game. But she didn't go completely bonkers either. She wasn't playing stupid shots. And that, you know, it was a really productive inning. So massive credit to her. Eventually she got out. You know, that happens. You know, and it was still a very decent innings. But, you know, once she got out, yeah, everything rather fell apart, didn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, it very much felt like that England were playing with John Ball in mind, this philosophy of inspire and entertain, although I'm not convinced that it was particularly inspirational or really entertaining to watch a sea of England players come to the crease, play a not particularly wise shot.
I think it's entertaining if you're a New Zealand fan.
Probably entertaining if you're a New Zealand fan, yeah, but I'm not quite sure that that's what the point of the philosophy is. But the issue to some extent is, you know, it probably won't make any difference in the series, right? Because England had two reasonably convincing victories in the first two T20s, in both of which they batted first. And they've obviously got their four best players coming back to join them for the remaining two T20s of the series. So in all likelihood, they will win this series very easily. But they can't afford to be doing that kind of thing that they did today in a World Cup situation, right? That's the issue. And the other thing is that it does seem to be a little bit of a worrying trend, as I've previously written in The Guardian under John Lewis, that England do have these kind of inexplicable batting collapses and just look very frail. I mean, we've now seen it against Sri Lanka in September. We saw it to some extent in the test in India. Okay, that's a different format, but it definitely felt like
it was
a similar
exactly the same problems.
Issue. And now we've seen it against New Zealand. And after those first T20s, you know, we were both writing and saying, well, it doesn't look like New Zealand are capable of winning a game against this England team, even a kind of depleted England team. But actually, they did, and they really shouldn't have.
Well, I think that's the point, that they shouldn't have. I mean, you know, let's think about, you know, what New Zealand got right. Obviously, Sophie Devine played an incredible innings.
Yeah.
And, you know, going into the death phase, you know, they looked like they were going to maybe make 130. And to have made, you know, in excess of 150 was a fantastic performance. And I'm, you know, very much supported by Amelia Kerr as well. I do think it's interesting that Amelia Kerr is clearly much more of that supporting role. And it's almost like an Amelia Kerr was the one thing that England actually lacked at the end there, because there was no one that was capable of playing that supporting role. England's new generation coming through are really exciting, and we get really excited by a lot of the things that they're doing. You know, we get really excited when, you know, Danny Gibson comes in at the end of a T20 and does, you know, a reverse and it goes for four and it wins the game, and we're like, yay. But you know, there are times when that kind of style of play is not appropriate. Yeah. And we have a group of players that don't seem to be capable of switching down a gear and going, well, hang on, we only need to run a ball here. You know, we don't need to, you know, play, you know, a glory mode to cow corner. Yeah. Because it's just not worth. You don't need six runs.
No.
You know, the ball that Bess Heath, you know, got out to, you know, a prod through point would have been, you know, well, a lot more productive than getting out, that's for sure.
Yes, they didn't need to hair off after it, did they? And it, as I say, it just felt like they'd gone out there with kind of John Lewis's words ringing in their ears, and prodding it through point is not an entertaining or inspirational shot. On the other hand, it would have won you the game.
Yeah, and you know, certainly if, you know, a four at that point prodded through backward point, a shot that Maya Bichet had played earlier in the game, you know, quite exquisitely, but it's, you know, it's not a shot that particularly looks good. It doesn't look good like a, even like a traditional glorious Sarah Taylor-esque club cover drive. But it can be very productive, and it's a reasonably safe shot as long as you play it along the floor. But we have too many players that seem only capable of swiping the ball in the air, particularly, you know, trying to thump it back over the bowler's head, because that's what they've been kind of taught to do. Is like, you know, and we in the media have kind of contributed to this a little bit. And I worry about it. And I also, you know, worry about what's coming through, because
look
at the England A team.
Yeah.
The England A team, just having won the T20 series, just lost the first game of their one-day series. And they were all, a couple of people got decent balls, but, you know, five or six of the batting lineup were out playing stupid shots, which were just like, you didn't need to play that situation in the game.
So England, they lost that match by 106 runs. So it was a complete wipeout by New Zealand A. And that's actually really interesting, because after that first T20, Sid, you wrote a whole piece about how you worry about New Zealand's kind of depth coming through and what's their next generation. But the focus has sort of switched to what's happening
well,
with
a little
England's
bit. I worry
year.
About that New Zealand's next generation are not capable of hitting sixes and finding the boundary. I worry that England's next generation, that's all they're capable of, and that we've selected an entire generation that are capable of playing in the 100 and, you know, potentially hitting 20 off 10 balls. But, you know, the trouble is that if you're Alice Capsey, you can do that. Not just because Alice Capsey actually can play all around the ground, and she's got the whole range of shots that a lot of these other players don't really have, but because Alice Capsey's actually going out there and proving it. If you're going to be that kind of player, you have to actually win games regularly for your teams, as Alice Capsey, you know, did in the WPL, as she's done for England. And if you're not doing that, then that's actually unhelpful. Mm. And if you've got nothing but players that can do that, then we see what happened today, where panic sets in and, you know, you wind up, you know, well, where they ended up. And really, you know, it should have been Bess Heath and Danny Gibson that brought it home, to be honest.
Yeah.
They shouldn't have left poor old Holly Armitage to, you know,
Nightmare situation.
Walk in, you know, what must have been like the weirdest flipping day of her entire life. Because to be told at the beginning of the day, you're not playing.
Yeah.
And presumably she knows, she'll know in her heart of hearts, this was her chance. I'll be amazed if she ever plays for England again. And you know,
well, you never know.
You never know.
But this was a big opportunity.
This was
definitely
her chance. And you know, to be told at the beginning of the day, you know, I'm sorry that you're not going to get it. You know, and you know that you're effectively on the plane back home after this, and they probably won't come around again. So the disappointment must have been huge. And then to get the chance to go in and actually win a proper cap when Sarah Glenn was concussion sucked, you know. That must have been that's the dream come true. But then to have to walk out in that situation and then end up, you know, walking back because she kind of cracked under the pressure, to be honest, didn't she?
But we can't blame her.
Oh, absolutely not. No, she shouldn't have been pushed. She shouldn't have been in that situation.
Great strategy from New Zealand, by the way, just to say, bowling Susie Bates for that last over. I'm not actually entirely convinced what Susie Bates' bowling style is these days since her injury. It just seems to be bowl it.
It's very slow,
very
fast, Raph.
Very straight and slow. And almost like a spinner, but she doesn't get
is
any.
Is it slow, fast, or fast, slow?
It's definitely not fast anything. So, but all they needed to do, all she needed to do, was just basically kind of bowl it straight and not leak runs, and they did it. It reminded me of a few years ago, kind of writing a whole piece about Susie Bates as a death bowler. I think that would have been in the Kia Super League days for Southern Vipers, but that was obviously pre-injury, and she was almost kind of shaping up to be this great death bowler, and here we are in 2024 and she's doing it again. Anyway, just thought that was worth mentioning. But yeah, I don't think we can blame Holly Armitage, I think. But it is a bit worrying. It's this kind of, I think it's like a sort of mental disease. It's like a mental frailty of players just getting a bit nervous and just approaching the game mentally wrongly. I don't think it's necessarily a technique issue.
That may be true. I think there is an aspect that we've kind of promoted those kind of players that, you know, that can play those glory shots, but perhaps can't play the more sensible shots. We have got one player. I mean, one of the things that England could have done was put in Charlie Dean.
Yeah.
You know, bumped her up two spots in the order, put her in before Bess Heath, because Charlie Dean is the kind of almost the one younger player
Capable of batting sensibly and doesn't lose her head. Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, you know, what about the next game, Raph? We've got the players coming back,
yeah.
Particularly at the top of the order. What do we think is going to happen at the top of the order? Because we've got, I mean, Alice Capsey clearly comes back in at three. So Maya Bouchier has lost her spot at three. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But, you know, does Maya potentially justify an opening spot, which she would like. She sees that as her role.
I think it would be really harsh to drop Bouchier after the innings that she played today. I think that would be really hard on her and would send out completely the wrong message.
So you're moving her up to the opening spot? I think potentially Danny Wyatt.
Has Danny Wyatt really done anything wrong? No, she just hasn't been there. Or she has been there, but she's been, having played WPL, they said she couldn't play those first three games. So I think maybe Wyatt and Bouchier. I don't see that Beaumont, unfortunately, has made a massively convincing case that she should be the opener. Now, I think that she should get a longer run and a longer go at it. But I feel that John Lewis is very will just be like, well, I did what you all said and I put her back in the team and now she hasn't really done anything. And so he will be open to discarding her, I feel. And I think that, again, Dunkley has not really done anything to overcome this kind of blip in form. She had like a little bit of an innings in the first game, didn't she? Like she hit 30-odd, but I don't think that she's been convincing enough. It certainly would feel harsh to me to drop Bouchier in order to retain Dunkley. But it's a huge issue for Lewis.
Yeah, no, I just don't know. I feel like that would be the right decision, but I just feel I can't see him dropping Dunkley. He's really committed to her.
Yeah, it's some cost fallacy at this point, isn't it?
Yeah.
He wants her to be the opener in the World Cup, so he's going to persist with her and he'll just justify it on whatever means he can find.
Ultimately, you know, if they win the World Cup and, you know, Dunkley hits 70 runs in the final, it's, you know, it's been the right decision. We'll see.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, shall we talk about something else shambolic that's happened this week, Sid? Do you like that segue? So talking about the 100 draft, we had a lovely, it was Wednesday evening, wasn't it? They had an hour. It was on YouTube this year, wasn't it? Rather than actually on Sky. And it was all a bit of a mess. They can't spell Naomi Detani's name correctly. Some of the presenters don't know how to pronounce names of various players. There were lots of issues with it. Apparently, Ebbs, who was one of the presenters, gave away that Ash Gardner
It was Meg Lanning, I think.
Oh, somebody on Twitter said that she'd given away that Ash Gardner had gone to Trent Rockets right at the beginning.
Oh, I thought it was Meg Lanning going Spirit, but anyway, there was stuff given away.
It basically showed that the process wasn't actually happening live.
Yeah, so we now know the process wasn't live. And yet they still managed to do things like make a mess of the graphics. How do you make a mess of the graphics when it wasn't live. Not just misspellings, but actually the graphics that showed the progress in the draft were a mess, and they kept like going back and forth. And it's like, hang on, you've done that bit of draft, and yet that's showing blank now.
But every year we seem to have one of these episodes where we talk about how terrible the draft is, and year the ECB find a new, different way to mess it up.
It was a different mess to last year.
Yeah,
to
a different
be fair.
Mess.
And you know, I think that doing the draft in advance did enable them to make it snappier. But then they did other things, like kept cutting back to the interviews, because they were like, well, you know, everyone's going to be bored now, so we've got to cut back to an interview. And then the draft prices are still rushing through on the screen.
And so it was very difficult to work out who had been picked up by who, for what salary band. And it was just all a bit confusing and odd.
Charles Dagnall did his noble best with it. Interestingly, Charles Dagnall appeared to have, he must have asked, I'm fairly certain that he didn't know who was going where, because he was too surprised when Risha Ghosh was selected by Birmingham Phoenix, with Phoenix having already selected Amy Jones. And I don't think you can, if he faked being surprised by that, he's go to Hollywood, Dagnall. Because you'll earn a lot more money in Hollywood than. So I think that he must have asked not to be told.
Yeah.
And, you know, he did a noble job trying to rush through
he
it.
He did.
But it, as a process, it just didn't really quite work.
We just
a lot of the players themselves were apparently a bit confused. They were watching it and going, "What have I been selected for something? Was that me that just flashed through there?" And Anyway, but what about the actual, you know.
Yes, Sid, I know that you felt that there were a couple of surprises in particular in terms of people being picked up at maybe higher salary bands than we might have expected.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised at Annabelle Sutherland being picked up at the very top level.
Yeah.
She's kind of the one person at the very top level who was picked up that isn't sort of that global superstar level yet. She sat out a lot of the WPL, but, you know, she has played well in England last summer. So, you know, maybe that turns out to be a sort of an inspired selection.
Yeah.
The other one that I was definitely surprised about, and you might be surprised that I'm surprised, was Grace Scrivens being picked up for 40,000. So that's in the second tier. So, you know, she was picked up in the sort of the second round of the draft. And that's quite a lot of pressure on a very young player.
And it's a big leap
with huge potential,
for her, isn't it? Because she's been on one of the lowest bands for Spirit, as we understand it, and has not been consistently playing for them.
T20's not her strong suit, but, you know, she's been picked up, she'll be pushed into that role, and I guess that means that she'll, you know,
She will play every game.
She will be playing every game.
She needs to earn that.
It's a great opportunity for her. But there's also that's a big amount of pressure. And if she can soak up that pressure and use it to her advantage and have a good T20 season, then all well and good, but it's a lot to put on her. What about best buys, Raph? Who are your best buys from the draft?
Yeah, well, firstly, I was really pleased to see Chamari Attapattu picked up at the top band. I think that's brilliant and kind of great for Oval Invincibles, because obviously, actually, we haven't seen her really be picked up as an automatic selection for the last couple of franchise tournaments, but she was so good in England last summer. You just feel that she can really make a difference for them. But the other two who I thought were kind of bargain picks Amanda Jane Wellington going to Invincibles for 30k. Wow, I mean, she's basically been one of the best bowlers in the competition for the first 3 years. So that feels like a bit of a bargain to
me. I'd have been less surprised at her being picked up for 50k than I was by Sutherland.
Yeah, exactly, because she's shown that she can do it in this particular competition. So I think that's really good. And also Jess Jonathan being picked up by Welsh Fire, again, for 30k. Given her recent form in the WPL as one of the leading bowlers in that, I thought that she might go for a bit more, actually. So I think that that's a really solid pick for somebody in that that would be the third salary band. Mm-hmm. Those two picks, I think, were really good.
Right. What's next, Raph?
What's next? Well, a strange one, Sid. Cricket Scotland have made an announcement this week. There's going to be a Super 10 franchise tournament taking place in Aberdeen. I don't think they've said what it's going to be called yet. But basically, there's going to be a men's that's going to be 2 weeks in August with 6 teams. And there is going to be a women's component to it that's going to be over 3 days with two teams, so two squads of 15. So much smaller scale for the women. But the even odder thing is that it's happening in August, and the women are playing for the first 3 days of it. And it's a direct clash with the final weekend of the 100, in which obviously, so I think it's three Scottish players who are playing in that this year. Alyssa Lister, and obviously the two Brices.
And potentially more as well, because there's still, like, there's still, despite the fact they kept this very quiet, there's still 16 picks for the 100
right,
to come. There is still a sort of direct signing route still to
there
come for that, where people like Abdul Maksud might still get picked up in that.
But obviously the Brices are a huge miss.
Yeah, they're your big
if
draw.
If you're trying to have kind of what's meant to be like a really high profile tournament in Scotland that's going to somehow land Scotland a load of money and a load of attention via broadcasting and stuff like that. That just seems a really strange decision. And it almost feels to me like the women's bit has been sort of tacked on, because Cricket Scotland have had a few kind of negative PR moments over the last few months, shall we say. The latest was the release of this report, which basically said that Cricket Scotland's been really sexist. And has been completely like not investing fairly in the women's side of things. So it feels like Cricket Scotland have gone, oh, we need a good headline for women's cricket. Oh, let's say that the women are going to play as kind of a much very minor role in this tournament that we've preconceived. But yeah, the whole thing's a bit odd, isn't it, Sid?
Well, I mean, okay, I mean, the entire thing is a bit odd, actually. Now, I've gone back and I've had a look at Scotland are partnering with an American businessman to run this thing. I've gone back and had a look to see what I can find out. The company that they're partnering with don't appear to have really any track record of running any sports tournaments, any media events, anything like that. The MD of that company doesn't have a long track record of managing stuff. He's run an IT company, but there's no indication online that it's a particularly big company.
Okay.
I'm not going to say too much about this, but I think there's one thing that I can legally safely say, and that is that if I was, you know, advising any player contemplating playing in this tournament, I would say make sure you get the money up front.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, we'll have to see what happens with that, because the Cricket Scotland are, as we understand it, trying to attract kind of overseas players to play in this, aren't they? Both the women's and the men's.
get the money up front.
I can't understand why they've scheduled the women's bit to clash with the 100. That's the bit that's maybe the oddest to me, because if they'd scheduled the women's bit for like the middle of the men's tournament or the back end,
then they could have
actually potentially not only got the Scottish players back from the 100, but some of the overseas players from the 100 could have gone, oh yeah, I'll go up and play
or some
in Scotland
of the English players that weren't that, you know, that aren't playing in the, you know, T20 World Cup might have been looking at that. So anyway, it's all a bit strange.
Okay. Now, Australia, Sid, have been in the news this week for a couple of reasons. Firstly, they've been playing this series in Bangladesh, and they're 2-0 up in the ODIs. What have you made of the cricket so far, Sid?
Well, I think the key thing to come out of it so far is just an indication of, you know, Australia have won these games very easily. They bowled Bangladesh out twice for under 100. But the key thing is that batting in Bangladesh is going to be tough. You know, you have to have an incredible amount of resilience and patience. You've got Beth Mooney, you know, hitting, what, some of that 26 runs off 70-odd balls or something like that.
In the first match.
So, you know, in this T20 World Cup that's coming up, batting is going to be really hard. You're going to have to really work for your runs. It could well be a very, very different T20 World Cup to the bish, bash, bosh kind of cricket that we've seen. And your teams are going to need to adjust.
Incidentally, it's really not going to suit England, and it's really not going to suit John Ball as a style of play, to be honest.
Yeah, so I think that's the lesson, really, that Australia have had to really graft to get those victories, even though, you know, they've bowled the opposition out cheaply. So I think that's the key lesson there.
Interesting. The other bit of news is kind of something that's happened within Australia by Cricket Australia. That doesn't impact on the Australian women's team directly, but Cricket Australia have announced their decision to cancel or to postpone another series against Afghanistan, a men's series. So they were due to play them for, I think it was 3 ODIs in the UAE in August, so on kind of neutral territory. And Cricket Australia have been very upfront and said the reason for this is that we've had conversations with the government, with our government, and conditions for women and girls are getting worse. So we're not prepared to play Afghanistan at this time. Now, it's fair to say that this decision has not gone down without a decent amount of controversy on social media, Sid.
Yeah, I mean, some people have been saying, you know, well, you know, even if Cricket Australia, really believed this, they would have not played, they would have refused to play Afghanistan in the World Cup, for example. What's your response to that, Raf?
Yeah, I mean, I think Cricket Australia have kind of addressed this themselves. What they've said is that it's not in our power to prevent Afghanistan from playing in the World Cup. That's an ICC decision, and the ICC is kind of a conglomerate of all of the cricket boards. So whether Australia had played Afghanistan in the World Cup or not, Afghanistan would still be there and still, you know, getting airtime and getting viewer time, and that that participation legitimising, therefore, the rule of the Taliban, who we know are very invested in the success of the men's cricket team. But Cricket Australia do have the power to decide who they play bilaterals against. That is entirely within their gift. And so this is something that they can control. So that's why they're not doing it. So it's a different scenario. And what they're saying is that we don't want to play a bilateral series against them and legitimise the Taliban in that way. Now, you know, people can criticise them and kind of say, oh, yeah, there was even people on Twitter saying this is worse than Cricket Australia just doing nothing because they're accusing them of hypocrisy. But that kind of sort of like very sort of pure, slightly kind of... I'm not expressing this very well, but I think that really frustrates me, the perspective of, well, doing something is worse than doing nothing. If nothing else, what Cricket Australia have done is bring the plight of women and girls in Afghanistan back into the
back into the public eye.
Yeah. And so that conversation is now being had again on social media. Nobody else has done anything to support the women and girls of Afghanistan. Nobody else in cricket has done anything. So to come out and criticise Cricket Australia and say, oh, well, they're just hypocritical. Well, I think people who are doing that need to take a bit of a look at themselves and go, well, what have you done? What have you done to support women's cricket in Afghanistan? What have you done to try to uphold the ICC's own rulings on having a women's cricket team being the thing that you need to do to be a full member? And the answer for basically anybody else in the world is nothing. So I just found some of this moralising about Cricket Australia and accusations of hypocrisy really made me a bit cross and a bit depressed, actually, because, it can't possibly be worse than doing nothing. Even if we would like Cricket Australia and other cricket boards to be doing more, this is at least something, mm-hmm. and it's an important something.
Okay, and it was really great to also see this week, I mean, partly as a result of this, one other big name in cricket come out, in support of the Afghan women's team and in kind of saying that, you know, we haven't got this right.
Yeah.
Because Ishika doing that during a Q&A as part of the MCC Cowdery lecture is a huge thing. And it's a huge thing for her as well, because she's effectively coming out against the BCCI by doing this. She earns, you know, I would imagine some very decent money from the BCCI for, you know, working, you know, over the years in the IPL. So, you know, she's taking a genuine personal risk by doing this. She's a very high profile person in India, a high profile person in the game. And the fact that she's bravely come out and said, no, guys, this is wrong. The ICC are wrong about this. I was really pleased to see somebody else with high profile join. You know, Alison Mitchell, who really has felt like a bit of a lone voice among the people at the top end of the men's game, you know, because, you know, it really felt like Ali Mitchell was just like crying in the wilderness at that hot, high end, you know, way above where we are in that pecking order.
Absolutely.
So
It's really important that those kind of voices actually do speak out against what's going on.
Yep.
And finally, Sid, just quickly, we did have a question come in that we weren't able to, we didn't find the time to answer in last week's podcast. It's kind of an interesting one. Following on the back of a very successful WPL, do you think there should be a competition for women among the top teams of WBBL, the 100 and the WPL, kind of all together playing each other?
I think this sort of thing definitely sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I always thought it would be great if we could have some sort of, you know, sort of super county championship between like the winners of WNCL and the winners of the county championship
in the old days
in England. I think the key issue nowadays is that that's probably unrealistic just because there's too much crossover within the teams. You know, they did try this briefly in the men's game, and the trouble was that the BCCI went, well, of course, that any players that play for all three teams will, of course, play for the Indian team in this, and that kind of killed the entire thing, really, because it meant all the best players were, you know, we're going to play for the Indian version, and at that point, you know, interest subsided substantially everywhere else, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, so it's overlapping players, isn't it? And obviously the other thing is trying to find time for it in the schedule would be quite difficult.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, there's...
So we think it's a lovely idea,
and
we'd definitely try and get there if it did happen, but probably not realistic, unfortunately. Wow, Sid, this might have been our longest episode ever. It's a bit of a mammoth one. Thanks for bearing with us. Hopefully you did manage to stay awake for the whole episode. Sid, well done for staying awake
Thanks.
For the whole episode. We'll see you in a week's time. Bye for now.
Bye.